and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about the history of magic, and I had fully intended to get quite quickly on to the what I consider to be the golden age of magic, the late 19th century, early 20th century, and basically, Jem didn't want me to do that, it seemed, during the podcast, just kept asking me other questions about the history of magic. And
well, it is, of course, a long history, isn't it? And I think that, you know, we see this in so many other things. I remember reading, it was like a history of Britain, and the first chapter was everything up to 1066. It's like, wow, okay. And, you know, then went into great depth about everything else, but it's like, okay, but that's only 900 years, but you're summarizing thousands of years in the first chapter. And, it, you know, I just didn't want it to go like that with the magic as well. As, you know, we started off by saying how it was kind of indistinguishable from ritual and almost religion. But as we, you know, as we said, or I said, Houdini was not only extraordinarily talented, he was also lucky that he seemed to have been born into the... He was the right age at the right time when magic kind of went to another level. And I believe, Greg, we have somebody who can help us with this story.
We have indeed, because we decided we'd come back and we'd talk about the golden age of magic. And we were both well aware that if it was another episode of me going on and on and on and on and on about how much I love magic and how great it is, we wouldn't get anywhere. So what we've actually done is we have brought in the wonderful Joe Klein to join us on the podcast. Hello, Joe.
Yay! Hello.
Now, I'm really excited because now I'm going to go on and on and on about magic.
Jem will now be quiet for half an hour.
Yeah, Jem, go and put the kettle on. No, Jem, I think you're going to be the one that's leading this discussion because you're the one that knows, sort of as it were, the layperson knowledge of magic. If we start to go too deep or anything else, you're the one that's going to be responsible for sort of pulling us out of the rut. So, Joe, would you agree, first of all, would you agree with our basic premise that the golden age of magic brings us to the late 19th, early 20th century?
Yes, I absolutely would. It's my favourite period of magic. I have so many books on it. I wish I was there right now.
Okay. Now, I'm going to start with a slightly technical question. As we obviously already said, even on this podcast, the history of magic goes way, way back. Why? Why was it such a big deal then? What sort of social elements allowed this to suddenly become one of the premier pastimes or entertainments of that age?
Well, I think there are various technological things. The first one, obviously, is going to be transportation and communication. You can actually sell a show, and somebody like Houdini or Thurston or Keller, the big magicians of the age, they could travel around the country or indeed around the world much, much easier than they could before. I think that's a major factor.
Which is actually quite bizarre because they used to travel big. These are big stage shows. I mean, when I do magic shows now, my entire act fits in my handbag. But this was the era of the big stage show and what we call box jumpers, I suppose, in some ways. That's a little bit derogatory, but really big apparatus. So if you did travel with a stage show, you were looking at huge amounts of equipment that needed to be transported around the world.
And so when you get the train coming in, especially I know America's one of the big hubs, London as well, of course, but you could suddenly take this whole show, pack it onto a train, move it to the next town, in a way that would have been impossible in the 18th century, for example.
Now, I find that really interesting because, as you've already said, in my mind, you know, if you look at someone like David Blaine or something like that, you imagine he could probably put most of his stuff into a suitcase. So you just said handbag, etc. And of course, Houdini, you can correct me on this, Greg, but the thing that most people associate with Houdini is that sort of big sort of glass tank thing where you're sort of like dangled upside down in chains or whatever. I don't know if that was even actually something that Houdini did, but it's something that people perhaps incorrectly associate with him. Okay, so, you know, that's more than a suitcase, but you're talking about what sounds like an entire cargo, you know, a cargo load in a train, really, for magic tricks. Is that fair?
Well, the other thing is that you actually couldn't just sort of pick up the stuff when you arrive at your destination. All your stuff had to come with you because I don't want to give this away too much, but they weren't just ordinary things a lot of the time. was, I don't want to shock you or surprise you, but it was very imperative that you traveled with all your stuff. I know, I mean, I've actually left my magic kit at home before and had to pick up my entire act at Bunnings on the way to a gig. I can do that, but I know other magicians, when they come to Australia, they have to borrow other people's animals. So, for example, doves, I've seen that not go well. I'm doing a competition. Someone from, I think it was Hong Kong, had to borrow someone else's doves, and they weren't trained the same way as his. So they basically took and went and sat on the rafters and pooped over everyone.
But, yeah, essentially you're correct. It's huge. The trick you're alluding to with Houdini there is what's called the Chinese water torture cell. It's the one in the fifth, I think it's the 50s movie, they had him actually dying inside it. That bit's not correct. But you think that's one act out of his entire set. And, of course, they'd bring the scenery, they'd bring the props. They really did dress up the stage as well. If they were going to do, let's say you're going to do the old Iron Maiden trick. You're going to put an assistant into a box with spikes in it and you're going to close the box on them. They wouldn't do that just having that box on stage. They would actually dress it up as a piece of theatre. So you might have, I don't know, an Egyptian sarcophagus with the spikes inside it. You'd have mummies on stage. You would have an entire temple backdrop. It really was theatre as much as it was magic a lot of the time.
And they quite often, nowadays it's like, here's the trick. I guess in those days, and I sort of seen elements of this, they told an entire story. So there's like almost like a 10-minute play leading up to the trick, and the trick is, if you like, the crescendo of the play, as it were.
That's absolutely right. And also things have sped up now, so you're supposed to pack a few more things in. But which brings me to one of the buildings of the Golden Era, which was, of course, the Egyptian Hall in London, which I'm a bit devastated isn't still there. But
I was going to say, you say, of course, never heard of it.
So
we got somebody in Melbourne telling somebody in London about something in London. Off you go.
Oh, well, it's it was a sort of palace of Mr. Masculine and Cook performed there. And it was, the outside of it had sort of these pillars, and it had a sphinx on the, you know, it had all these, you know, philosopher's stone and all these things on it to make it sound really mystic, because of course magicians really played on the connections of the unknown. So at the time it was the mystic East, it was India, the Indian rope trick, it was China, and you know, these things, because they weren't known, were really, really magical and mystical. And when you went into a building like that, you felt that it was a special magical location. And many, Masculine, I think, performed there for about 30 years. So it's booked out pretty much for his show.
And I think the basic concept you've got to get in your head, Jim, for when you're thinking about this era, is these days magicians, I think, are much more like stand-ups. An awful lot of them is, as you say, really how little stuff can carry on stage. Back then, a magic performance was much more like a big musical. It had to have the big set, it had the flash, it had the flair. And you could get away with things that these days we'd consider to be incredibly cheesy in magic. Back then, you would have them coming on in robes. And when I say cheesy, obviously I mean partly cheesy, and obviously I mean to a certain extent incredibly racist. when we end up in the world of people, like Chung Ling Su, who I know Joe must know all about.
Oh my God, I love him. Audacity. I love him. Jem, have you heard of his real name was Billy Robinson. Have you heard of him?
Okay, well, I think you've given away what's going on there, really.
Greg loves him, so he must have heard of him.
He has actually mentioned him before. But again, perhaps if you could put him into the context of the era. And actually, just before you do, you know, the basic rule on this podcast, and indeed me whenever I'm writing history books, is you got to judge people on what society was like at the time. And I think at the moment, in particular, in Britain, there's an awful lot of, well, if this person lived today, they'd be a racist or whatever. And it's like, well, you know, I don't think that, look, some of these people were racist and horrific and, you know, into eugenics and all this sort of horrific stuff. But there were some people, well, this guy was just trying to earn a living, and he was trying to look a bit sort of, you know, trying to be a bit magical. Everyone considers China a bit magical, so he was going with that. Is that fair?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you cannot judge society by what happened in the past. And the other thing is, I don't think he was ever racist. I think he really admired Chinese magicians, and that's why it was, I suppose, flattery. I think he was really taking on board that he thought they were wonderful and modelled himself on it. So the backstory is an American man named William Robinson was a magician, and he decided that as part of his act, which actually sort of became like a piece of performance art because it became his life, that he would take on the persona of a Chinese magician called Cheng Ling Su. So he didn't just perform as him. So some magicians would just perform, but he pretended to be Chinese for his life, his entire life.
Oh, my God, really?
Yes. So whenever he was in public, he dressed like a Chinese man, and he always spoke. He didn't actually speak Chinese, but what he did speak was sort of an impression of Chinese. And whenever he was interviewed by the newspapers, he would have an interpreter. So he would say something in sort of mock Chinese, and
they would
translate it to the newspaper person. Of course, it played on the idea that not many people knew Chinese people. I don't know what real Chinese people thought about this, but to me, looking at the pictures, he doesn't really look Chinese at all. What he has is his hair in a queue, so a long ponytail. It's dyed black, and he wore sort of these really elaborate Chinese silk robes. So it wasn't until he actually died on stage from the result of a bullet catch that went wrong, and he uttered his final words in English, that people even realised that he wasn't Chinese.
Oh, that's a great story. That's a brilliant. I mean, that's what a great. I think it's safe to say he went out the way he probably would have wanted to. A bit like Tommy Cooper.
Well, I'm not entirely sure.
Have either of you seen The Death of Tommy Cooper?
Yes, I have. Yeah,
because I was old enough to be watching it as a child. And so I remember, I mean, this is probably one of the only times on British TV somebody's actually died live on TV. And the remarkable thing is, because, well, you know, Tommy Cooper, comedian slash magician, and he's doing an act, and then he just falls on the floor. I mean, colossal heart attack, it turns out. And then the curtains come down. Everybody's laughing. Everybody thinks it's part of the show. Nobody quite gets it. And come on, that's the way he would have wanted to have gone.
Oh, I agree. There's a famous story in Melbourne about an actor called Federici who died by performing Faust. And, of course, now his ghost haunts the theatre, and there is an ice cream named after him. So, you know, but everyone was really spooked because, you know, he played the devil. It's a show about, you know, life and death and bargaining with your eternal soul, and he died during the show. So, you know, ugh. It was a bit creepy, but I agree what you were saying about what you can get away with now and what you could get away back then. Without giving too much away, there's also a very popular magic technique called black art illusion. Is that ringing a bell with anybody?
Not with me.
No, I can't say this here.
Without giving too much away, theatres at the time were mostly lit by these gas lights, which actually caused a lot of fires. A lot of theatres burnt down. But it meant that the lighting wasn't fantastic, which was really great for magicians because they could hide stuff more easily. And you were able to levitate people and do all sorts of tricks by simply having a black stage where the thing that you wanted to remain hidden, for example, the pole holding up the assistant, could be covered with a black cloth. And in this subdued lighting, it actually looked really magical. So it is sometimes used today, but I'd say not as much.
And funny you should say that. There's a late Laurel and Hardy movie where it's all set around a stage, and there's a magician performing. It's the classic thing of you drape a cloth over a woman. She's there. He drapes the cloth over the woman. It then sort of levitates, and then he yanks the cloth away, and the woman's disappeared. But I just happened to notice, or clattering at the back of the stage, was a black painted frame, mesh of what a woman's body would have looked like. So, you know, unfortunately, caught on film is one of the ways that you can pull that gag or get, you know, that trick, which is exactly what you've just described there. And of course, yeah, with modern HD, you know, everyone's got an iPhone now or equivalent. It's very hard to pull those sorts of tricks like that nowadays, isn't it?
Well,
it is.
the most impressive trick used to be levitating something, and I've seen a lot of modern magicians doing it. And I have to say it doesn't resonate with the audience anymore because there are so many mechanical things now that means you can have an engine in something and you can levitate things or can be remote controlled, that what used to be the greatest trick in magic is pretty much, unless it's done in daylight in full view, but on stage, people just aren't as impressed as they used to be.
I think the other problem is when you get to the golden age of magic, when they could present their magic, as we said, they did this, all these different styles. They might make it Egyptian, they might make it Chinese, but they took these different elements, these different styles, and they presented it as magic. You know, people would come on stage and say, I learnt my magic from the masters of magic in this country. I travelled to this place to learn my mystical powers. And they very often did present it as a mystical display, as magic, as this and that. And these days, magicians very much shy away from that sort of presentation, because if you walk on the stage and you say, I'm going to fly, the audience say, no, you're not. Someone's going to pull you up on a bit of string, you know. Whereas back then,
and there'll be loud music to cover the noise of the machinery.
That's it. And people would buy into it a little bit more back then than they do now. And the other thing, of course, is that a lot of tricks have kind of seeped away, you know, sort of secrets have gone away. The internet has taken over and things, and people know the mechanics a lot more. In fact, the last person I've heard of recently that actually did a Chinese character for their magic, and who is now an incredibly famous magician, is another one of my heroes I bring up quite often, and that is Teller of Penn and Teller. He's obviously famous these days for performing silently, but when he was young, he actually took inspiration from Chung Ling Su.
Wait, and did you see him talk? Did you actually see him talk?
Oh, I've spoken to him. Yeah, I've seen his show. After his show, he talks live, and he's. But I heard an interview with him, and I actually heard him from. It was about 2 years ago. I had this interview. I heard him do his spiel as he did it as a child, being this Chinese character who comes in and says, you know, I've magically transported myself through time to the present day to bring you magic. And you sit there and you think, magicians don't say stuff like that anymore. They let you be fooled, they let you be tricked, but, you know, you got Derren Brown. This is a mix of psychological illusion and this. They call themselves illusionists, they call themselves tricksters. Nobody stands there, you know, or very, very few magicians stand there and go, I am actually magic. I'm actually going to make this person disappear. And I don't think that's because the people in the beginning of the century believed it more. I think it's just that ability to suspend your disbelief has gone away a little bit.
It's gone out of fashion, I think. I mean, I think we like to think that magicians are more psychologists, and also the plainclothes magician. I mean, before the golden age of magic, almost all magicians used to dress up as wizards. So you can imagine that. And, of course, they started wearing these dinner jackets, you know, and the suit and tails. And now magicians usually will wear jeans and, you know, a T-shirt and maybe a jacket.
Particularly when you think of people like Dynamo and you know, well, actually, I guess Derren Brown's slightly more Victorian. He certainly dressed smartly, his suits. But
yeah. But,
you know, a lot of them are like they could just be walking down the street. And I guess that's the angle in the past has been, ooh, this is mystical. You can't possibly do this because I've come from ancient China. Whereas nowadays it's like, look, I just look like the average guy on the street, but I'm about to wow you with some sleight of hand. And I absolutely agree. We are, I think today we're less impressed by the big, huge theatrical stuff because we know there are tricks involved, but it's the up close hand magic where you're thinking, I've had it done to me. Somebody moved the logo of the Apple logo on the back of my iPhone and he did it in front of my eyes, and it's like, well, clearly it's a trick, but I have no idea how he did it. He doesn't have a huge machine behind him to do it. Well done you, sir, for pulling that on me.
It is the most powerful way to do magic these days. The other thing is all the things, the wizard robes, the dinner, you know, suit and tails, and the contemporary jacket and jeans. I think they all have in common is pockets. So hide a lot of things under. And I don't know if anyone's ever looked on the inside of a magician's jacket, but spoiler alert, there's usually a lot of extra bits and pieces in there. I mean, I I have a lot of extra pockets sewn into my jacket. I'm a bit devastated, though, because the dry cleaner melted the collar recently, and I'm like, do you know how much work it will be for me to re-gimmick another jacket with lots of extra pockets? So, you know, it's the pockets. It's the place to disguise stuff. So it doesn't really matter what you wear as long as it has that thing in common.
Well, of course, there's a drawback there because the amount of women's skirts and dresses that don't have pockets, there are a few, and it kind of, if I was a woman, I'd find that infuriating, but as a magician, that's lethal.
Oh, I don't actually wear dresses. I mean, in doing magic, it's just too hard. I need at least 6 to 8 pockets. That's what I do. And that may seem excessive and greedy in terms of pocket.
If you want to hear excessive and greedy in terms of pocket, you need to go and listen to Penn Jillette's podcast, and you need to listen to the episode where he has Piff the Magic Dragon on. And if anyone who doesn't know who Piff the Magic Dragon is, I won't spoil it, go and YouTube it. But he goes through how many pockets, he goes through every single one of the pockets that he has hidden in this ridiculous dragon outfit that he wears. And it's something like 38 pockets he's got hidden around this...
It is. Yeah, I think it's a really amazing magician who his gimmick was that people would call out any paper item and he would have it in his pocket. So he would have his amazing jacket just gimmicked and he would collect any little bits of paper. Someone would say, oh, I want a bus ticket, you know, for the London circuit or whatever, and you pull it out. So not only did he have a zillion things in his jacket, he knew where everything was, and that was his act. Well, so, I mean, that's a lot of hard work right there. But if
Absolutely. Someone
he would make sure he had it for next time. So someone might say, oh, I want an identity card for the Masonic Lodge, and he would locate it in his sort of jacket filing system and pull it out.
Now, going back to our original history thing, I want to sort of link it to something else that we've been talking about, early cinema. Now, you know, we obviously, as we get towards the end of this podcast, I guess we need to find out why the Golden Age of Magic finished. But I'm just curious, did the Golden Age of, or the early cinema, did that help or hinder the magic movement, as it were?
Well, a lot of magical techniques were used in the early films. Sort of the avant-garde and the surrealist movements did kind of use it. But I suppose the thing is that people could see how things could be gimmicked, and magic might have lost a little bit of its magic, I suppose. The other thing is cinema was very portable. You just had a reel. You needed a place to put it. And I think it's the same thing with vaudeville. So vaudeville was dying about the same time as cinema as well. At the same time as magic. So they're all sort of interlinked.
And I think the thing with magic, though, and the reason that magic does sort of carry on, and it's the same thing, actually, that I find with juggling, and particularly with escapology, is it's never going to work as well on television as it does in real life. I've got a magic trick for you, Jem. I'm going to give away one of the most annoying magic tricks I've ever seen.
Okay.
And you will see this. You'll see magicians doing this, and you will... one magician does actually nod to the fact they're doing it. But this is a magic trick you could do tomorrow, Jem, and you could go and put on your YouTube channel. What the magic trick we're going to see on YouTube is you're going to walk out into the streets of London. You're going to go up to someone, you're going to hand them a deck of cards, you're going to let them shuffle that deck, you're going to let them pick one card at random, they're going to show you what that card is, you're going to lift up your shirt and you're going to have that card tattooed to your chest permanently there so you couldn't possibly have changed it or rigged it in any possible way. And I know at least one magician who's done this on a big TV special, and the secret to it, the big giveaway secret, is all you have to do is you take your film crew and you go on the street for a couple of hours
and you go
up to person after person after person after person until one of them gets it right and you stick that on the telly. And I think that's the problem with magic on television, is that we can all see, well, it can be edited, it can be cut in this way, you can keep repeating it until you get it right, you can keep going till you get lucky. And I think that's why magic does survive as an art form, and it's still one of the biggest, I think, of all the sort of performing arts outside of music, but of sort of the variety arts. It's one where most people are still actually making a fair amount of money out of it, because it doesn't work on television. You watch it, and I've never seen you see good magic and go, oh, that's really clever, but you never think, oh, well, that's completely fooled me, because you never know if there's an edit or a cut or a clever camera angle or what's happening.
That's it. In fact, they even do that scene in a Jonathan Creek episode where that magician, I can't remember his name, but he's sort of his engineer or his developer, and they do that exact thing where he has to keep asking people to name the card until he finally gets someone who goes, yep, and he's like, oh. Statistically, he keeps doing that.
And Derren Brown actually showed a similar thing on one of his prediction shows. He showed a prediction.
Yeah, horse racing one, yeah.
Yeah, and then he showed himself just redoing it over and over again. So you got that aspect to it. But yes, I think the Golden Age ends with cinema coming in and everything else, because suddenly you've got this entertainment, and especially then when we get to television, and that's kind of really puts a real push on all the variety arts, because trying to get people to leave, especially at this time of year over in England, I know it's different over in Australia at this time of year, don't rub it in, but trying to get people to leave their nice warm houses to go out in the cold to go somewhere to watch entertainment when they can just curl up in front of the telly is actually quite hard work.
That's true, with Netflix and all that sort of thing. And so the other thing is, I suppose, when you're bereft of entertainment, you know, what's out there, I mean, it's so hard to compete. We actually have a fantastic festival in Melbourne called Melbourne Magic Festival. And a lot of magicians do shows during these 2 weeks of the festival. And it's almost like a sort of flood of magicians coming from not just Melbourne, but around Australia and overseas. And it's bizarre to see so much magic. I mean, sometimes there are three shows happening at the same time, several times a day. And the only place that sort of happens is the Magic Castle, I think. And it's bizarre to just have almost this surplus of magic.
It's interesting. So that that's still going on, yeah.
So what you're saying is that the, you know, it's technology that basically created the rise and fall of magic as a populist form of entertainment. You needed the telegrams, the newspapers, the trains and transportation to ship all these acts around the world. So that all helped in the 1880s and 1890s and 1900s. And even with the very, very early cinema, they needed the magician to show them how to do optical illusions and stuff like that. But once cinema had learnt those tricks, as it were, it then surpassed it, and then people found a new form of entertainment. They found their magic and their awe and wonder in looking at the spectacles of things like Cecil B. DeMille, rather than going to their local vaudeville house and seeing a bit of comedy, bit of musical, bit of magic. Is that fair?
Well, I think magicians have actually adapted. So there's amazing magicians now who use things like virtual reality. I don't know if you've seen Marco Tempest, but Google him, YouTube him. He is incredible because he combines virtual reality and really good sleight of hand close-up magic. And there's a lot of magicians who use things like iPads now for really good magic and comedy effect. So if you've seen some Penn & Teller, there's some great stuff there. And, of course, now, because everyone has a smartphone, most magicians will try and include something in their repertoire which relates to a smartphone. So instead of saying, you know, here's my here's my wallet, or I just happened to have bought this telephone directory with me. Do you know how magicians relied on having a telephone directory, and now they're going, can't get them anymore? Well, you know, they set off the act. Well, here's a telephone directory from 2005, and it just doesn't, you know, it just never the same ring, which is a pity, because there's some brilliant mentalism acts that relate to telephone directories. But now, the smart street magician will include something that involves a mobile phone.
And I think that is the important thing when we look back at the history of magic, is we talked about the rise of the suited magician, the tail-coated magician. I believe Rob Erhudan's usually credited with sort of bringing that in. And that was because suddenly, if you're wearing something natural, it works. And you occasionally see magicians now that miss the point. They try and dress themselves like the old-fashioned magicians, and it looks awkward, and tricks have to evolve. And that's why one of the great tricks of the Golden Age was pulling a rabbit out of a hat. Because back in those days, you could go into the audience and you could borrow a top hat, and when you made a rabbit appear out of it, that's a magic trick. These days, if I want to do that trick, I have to bring my own top hat, and suddenly the whole thing is incredibly suspicious from the start.
Yeah, it's funny.
Same
I actually
thing
have
with telephone books. Go on.
I actually have some top hats, and I can't think of any other reason that I would own them.
It's Ascot, darling. You're going to Ascot. That's what it is. I'm aware of time. I have one last question to ask, and it is actually to do with film. There's the movie The Prestige, Christopher Nolan movie. Obviously, it has some very non-magical, very fantastical elements to it. But there is a scene where Michael Caine showing them some of the tricks from allegedly the late 1800s, I should say. And there's a pigeon in a cage, and you sort of smash it down, and the pigeon disappears. But the reason why the pigeon disappears is because you just killed the pigeon, basically, in this sort of horrible trap thing. It strikes me that that's the sort of thing that might well have existed then. You know, magicians weren't so worried about animal cruelty in the 1890s as nowadays. Did you recognise that? Is that a thing?
Actually, it's funny you should say that, because just on a slight tangent, I used to work at a museum, and it was a very old museum. And of course, in the old days, that if they didn't have anything in their collection, they'd go, oh, let's go and get one of those. And they'd shoot it, stuff it, and put it in. And one time a kid said to me, did you kill all these animals? And I just went, further compliment. But the idea was that that animals were props, and if you're going to use props every day, you certainly wouldn't kill them. So I can see birds were quite cheap at the time, and yeah, it's quite possible in the past that it had that kind of, they're expendable. But I would say magicians are really cheap. They don't have – I'll be honest, they're cheap. You know, if you go out to dinner with magicians, you know, the bill goes and everyone's run out. And sorry, that was a bit slanderous. I hope no magicians are listening and suing me about that. But they don't actually want to pay money out to replace anything. Most magic effects are ones you can easily reset. And even though if you want to give something out, it's usually quite cheap and easy to replace. So if you had to buy a rabbit every time or buy a bird every time, A, it would be expensive, and B, inconvenient. So I'd say that there's probably a little bit less of that going on at the time, and I'd say certainly I don't know anyone today who kills their magic animals.
Oh, no, I'm not saying now, but no. back in the day, maybe. But I loved your argument about cheapness there.
Wouldn't surprise me. I would also, I've mentioned once already on the podcast, I will also mention that Piff the Magic Dragon got in a lot of trouble in one of his shows. He got a lot of complaints for the trick where he, you know, magically, and this is the important word, fires his chihuahua out of a cannon into a brick wall with a splat. And a lot of people, and his way of diffusing that when he got asked about it was not to say, well, obviously I don't hurt my pet. His was, yeah, but it's really annoying every week to have to go out on the highway and pick up another bag of chihuahuas.
No, the thing about it is, I don't know if it was part of his act, but for some reason he kept mentioning how much his chihuahua, Mr. Pibbles, I think it was.
Mr. Piffles,
was actually cost. And I was actually Twitter friends with his assistant at the time who looked after Mr. Pibbles a lot. So I don't know how much he cost really came into it a lot, suggesting to me that he, and there's a lot of photos of him all cuddled up together. And also there was a lovely story about when someone, well, it's not really lovely, but someone ripped off his entire act.
Yes.
And the thing he was most insulted about was they didn't buy a chihuahua. They had a guinea pig dressed up as a dragon. It cost $10. My chihuahua cost hundreds of dollars. Yeah. So that seemed to be the thing that really affronted him the most. So, but I have to say, really early magic, one of the earliest magic tricks was the substitution of a black and white, I think it was geese. So the magician cut off both their heads and swapped them over. So, yeah, it's very likely that early magicians, you know, did to kill their stage pets.
I'm afraid we are almost out of time. One other thing I will mention, because you brought up the Prestige gem, is if you've seen that film, the guy at the beginning of that film, if you remember, they go and they watch the guy's act to try and figure out how he did a trick. The guy who they go and see, that is supposed to be Chung Ling Su, who we mentioned earlier.
Okay.
Yep. Other than that, we've only got a couple of minutes left. We're running long, and I almost just let us run long there because I'm really enjoying this. So,
have a sequel? Can it be like stuff that we didn't get around to?
Yeah, History of Magic Part 3. I think that'll have to come out sometime.
I think so.
Jim, did you have anything else you wanted to ask Joe while she's here?
I've got nothing left. You know the sort of basic rules we do, Joe. You know, at the end of it, we normally plug our stuff, but this is a guest episode. So, Joe, what would you like to tell our viewers? This, I think this is going to be coming out early January. So, what's going on in January or February you'd perhaps like people to interact with you about?
Obviously, magicians, hit me up on Twitter, JoeKlein1. I know it's so original and, you know, really represents everything I'm about. But I love interacting with magicians. I'm hoping to do more magic this year. My last performance was as a ghost 1950s magical librarian. So I was like, you know, pulling out all the stuff.
How are we only hearing about that during the plug, right?
So I am actually hoping to put some stuff online. And if I say this here, it means I'll actually have to do it. So
yeah.
You can all write me emails, angry emails, if I haven't put anything up by January. So, but I'd say thank you so much for inviting me on the show. I love chatting with you guys. It's so exciting to talk to people about magic. I could talk for a few more hours, but...
But I was going to say, but to any male magicians who might want to be approaching Joe, do listen back, because there are two things you're going to have to prove to her. One, you have more than 8 pockets. That seems very important to her. And secondly, you better not be one of the cheap ones, okay?
Oh, and also, please don't harm any animals. Jem may have given away how one trick may have been done in the past. History Gems does not condone any magic that harms animals in any way, shape, or form.
Absolutely.
Although I will admit, as a magician, I do injure myself more often than not. So.
I think I always grab other magicians' animals and play with them as much as possible, but I have yet to be weighed on by a magic bunny, so I'm pretty proud of myself.
And there is our episode title for today. I have yet to be weed on by a magic bunny.
Can that be in the merchandise as well? Can that go on the...
Oh, that's the Joe Klein range. That's definitely the Joe Klein range.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for coming on. It's always a real pleasure to have you on. We will have you back on a little... Well, by the time this comes out, we're in 2018. So we'll have you back a little bit later this year for another episode. Jem... did you have anything you wanted to say to finish up?
No, you wrap this one up.
In that case, I will say a big thank you to Joe Klein, a big thank you to everybody listening, and of course, a massive thank you to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducci.
And yay, to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And thank you all. Goodbye, and take care.